It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, when's the last time you learned something completely new? We'll talk to the author of a new book about the joy of being a beginner, especially for grown-ups. First, President Biden has met with a bipartisan group of senators in hopes of crafting legislation to support America's infrastructure. Meanwhile, Wisconsin's roads currently have a D-plus grade, according to an annual report card from the American Society of Civil Engineers. States around the country and the federal government are trying to figure out the roadmap for the future of transportation infrastructure and how we pay for it. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What would you like lawmakers to do to address infrastructure, especially when it comes to roads and transportation? How are the roads in your local community? Do you have big problems there? Do you have questions about infrastructure? Who pays for it at the state and federal level? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Rocky Moretti is Director of Policy and Research at the National Transportation Research Nonprofit, TRIP. Rocky, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, this report from the Civil Engineers Group, they do all the infrastructure, keying in on roads here in Wisconsin, a D-plus grade. Now, when you see a grade like that for a particular state, what do you see contributing to possible problems with roads?
Well, that report really is consistent with the report that we put out 3 years ago in Wisconsin, which also found high levels of pavement deficiencies. And when you look at where that comes from, it obviously doesn't come overnight. It's really a combination of a lot of wear and tear on the system and a lack of long-term preservation. You have to make the initial repairs, but then as travel increases, if you can keep up with it, if you can keep the pavements in good condition, it's a lot more cost effective. But Wisconsin has fallen behind that.
Now, Wisconsin had its own story. I imagine a lot of states are, you know, have their own version of this. The funding mechanism for roads didn't keep up with the costs of roads. Indexing to inflation of gas taxes ended. Nothing was put in to fill that gap. There were years of budget debates over how to do that. The state in the last budget did boost some road funding. What does it take, though, to catch up when you're playing catch up like that?
It really takes all levels of government working together. You did mention the lack of the indexing of fuel fees in Wisconsin was very critical in keeping up with the losses due to inflation and also the growth in travel. Since indexing of the motor fuel tax was suspended in 2006, that's cost the state $2.3 billion. So obviously that's a huge hit. And as you mentioned, this last legislative session, a one-time additional piece of money was put into the system. But again, it takes long-term consistent funding. You mentioned the meeting of the Biden administration, a bipartisan meeting on Thursday with Senate leaders. They're looking at the federal surface transportation program, which provides over $800 million a year in Wisconsin for road and bridge repairs. And that program expires in September. And so part of the Biden administration's support for a long-term infrastructure package will be reauthorizing that long-term federal program. And that will take both the Senate and the House putting a bill together.
One long-term problem, Rocky, I've been hearing about for some years now is we pay for a lot of our transportation, roads and bridges in particular, through gas taxes. Well, cars are getting more fuel efficient. Some cars are partially electric. Some don't use gas at all. How big a part of the puzzle is that?
That issue is coming very quickly. And the other part of that, of course, is fuel efficiency. Today, the average vehicle on the road averages 24 miles a gallon. By 2030, that will be 31 miles per gallon. By 2040, 37 miles a gallon. And then in terms of electric vehicles, which now are around 2 or 3% of vehicle sales, by 2040, that's estimated to be 60%. So we're very quickly seeing a lack of long-term sustainability of the motor fuel fee. That doesn't mean that it still doesn't have value moving forward as a transitional source of funding. But the bottom line is that, as we point out in our report 3 years ago, when you don't make adequate investment it cost you, our estimate was around $7 billion, and that was $3 billion to motorists driving on rough roads, which is beating up their vehicle, about $2 billion in congestion delays, lost time and wasted fuel, and about $2 billion in the economic cost of serious and fatal traffic crashes. So at the end of the day, the consumer is in a much better position making those investments. But if you don't make the investments, those costs of not having good roads is going to increase.
We're talking about Wisconsin's and the nation's transportation infrastructure, cars and roads and other forms of transit and how we pay for it all. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What are the roads like in your neck of the woods? Are they kept up the way you hope they would be? If you're a truck driver, what are you seeing as you drive through Wisconsin and beyond? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Rocky, 2009 was it. We had the big stimulus package. It included a lot of infrastructure stuff. Under the Trump administration, a lot of people said President Trump and Democrats in Congress won't get along on much, but they might be able to get together on infrastructure and transportation. That didn't really happen. Do you see prospects for some kind of bipartisan agreement that, yeah, this is a good place to spend some cash?
I think one of the things that I think is going to be very helpful in really getting Congress and the administration together on this was a report 2 years ago from the National Academy of Sciences through the Transportation Research Board. It was asked by Congress to look at the nation's interstate system, clearly the backbone of the nation's economy, and tell them straightforward, what do we need to do? And basically what that report showed, and it's true in Wisconsin as the rest of the country, is the system was aging and had increasing operational and physical deficiencies, and it was no secret why, increasing levels of travel and a lack of long-term preservation and repairs. And so really Congress now has an opportunity through putting forward a new infrastructure program and reauthorizing a surface transportation bill to really approach what was discussed in this report from the Transportation Research Board, which is the tremendous need to modernize our interstate highway system. And also what the report pointed out is that as that system gets 50, 60, and 70 years old, as much of our infrastructure is, routine repairs have reached a point of diminishing returns. So that simple resurfacing doesn't last as long as it once did because we're coming to the point where literally we have to reconstruct major components of that system, bridges, interchanges, and they estimated that would require an increased investment of about 2.5 times greater than we're spending now.
Now, I've been talking about transportation infrastructure and talking mostly about roads and cars and trucks. What other things, rail and other systems, do you have your eye on?
Well, certainly if you look at the surface transportation system, and we're really looking at, if you look at the impact of the pandemic, had obviously a tremendous impact on our transportation system. Wisconsin, back in the spring, vehicle travel was down 36%. By early this winter, it was down around 12%. So travel's come about 2/3 of the way back. We're obviously not through the pandemic yet, but people are looking ahead to what those transportation needs will be beyond that. And I think a lot of that is to be seen in terms of a variety of patterns from employment to residential impacts. But I think it's clear that Americans are very mobile. We're going to continue to want and need that mobility. But really, the challenge is going to be funding this need to modernize the system moving into this post-pandemic era.
We're talking about transportation infrastructure and how we pay for it with Rocky Moretti, Director of Policy and Research at the National Transportation Research Nonprofit, TRIP. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see more money go into highway development and maintenance? Or how about your local roads? Do you feel like the state and your local government are able to keep up with keeping up your local roads and infrastructure? Do you want to see the federal government tackle a big infrastructure package, a lot of money that would include some form of transportation? Are there alternative transportation methods you want looked into more, funded better, whether it's rail or buses, or you fill in the blank there? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Rocky Moretti, Director of Policy and Research at TRIP, a national transportation research nonprofit. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want more money to go into roads? If so, what kind of roads? How are things near you? Do you want to see alternatives? 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a very controversial opinion, but I'm going to throw it out there. I know change is very difficult in Wisconsin. I mean, there's no doubt about that. It took us a long time to get Highway 53 north of Eau Claire to be a two-lane divided highway. So my opinion is this. We need, and it would be a tollway from like Duluth Superior along the South Shore of Lake Superior to Michigan. Highway 2 would be replaced by a two-lane divided highway tollway. And I think that could be part of a larger picture when you look at people who want to vacation up on the Great Lakes from Toronto to Winnipeg. You could do a southern route around the southern part of the Great Lakes, north of Chicago, instead of going over north of the north side of Lake Superior, Lake Huron. I, from Wisconsin's point of view, I would like the Highway 2 to be two-lane divided highway. I think the tollway would pay for it, but as part of a larger a picture of a highway from Toronto to Winnipeg.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Jeff's thinking big there. Rocky, I don't know if you have thoughts on his specific route, but people in Wisconsin have been floating the idea of toll roads and not rejecting it as some kind of Illinois concept like people used to. What do you think of the idea of toll roads or other user fee-based ways of funding highways?
Certainly the use of toll roads is on the ascendance, because what we're seeing is that obviously adding additional capacity comes at a significant price tag. States, including Wisconsin, have significant challenges in reconstructing and preserving the existing system. And so we've seen it mostly in urban areas where urban areas are adding additional lanes along existing interstates, sometimes allowing vehicles at a certain price to move into other traffic lanes to get there a little bit quicker, but to pay the premium. And so certainly allowing tolls as part of one of the options, really when you look at the tremendous transportation funding needs that are out there, ultimately the public is going to pay for it one way or another. Tolling is obviously a very pure way of saying if you want this mobility and this additional capacity, you're going to need to pay for it.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We'll go to Ann next in Milwaukee. Ann, hello.
Hi there. I'd like to make an observation about the varying quality of roads in Wisconsin. I spend a lot of time in northern Wisconsin where the roads, for the most part, seem in pristine condition. No potholes, no cracks, you know, still dark asphalt as though they've been done fairly recently for the most part. And I see road work going on all the time up there. I live in Milwaukee, where the roads are a mess, tons of potholes, just in very sad shape. And I understand there are different levels of government involved. Mm-hmm. But I also know that Milwaukee taxpayers send significantly more tax revenue, or let's just say Milwaukee sends more taxes to the state than it gets back in benefits. And this is a perfect example of it. And I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on that.
And thanks for the call. Do you hear this concern about kind of haves and have nots when it comes to, you know, one part of a state getting more revenue to maintain those roads than another?
Well, I think looking at the urban rural split, I think Ann's observations are consistent with what we see across the country, where on average, urban pavement conditions, just looking at least the surface pavement conditions, which is what we all care about, it's the roads we're driving on, are generally significantly worse as they are on rural roads. Now, a big part of that reason is obviously urban roads are getting significantly more travel. And, you know, as we point out in some of our recent reports, if you look during the pandemic when we've seen vehicle travel drop significantly and start to catch up, we're actually seeing more freight transportation than pre-pandemic. That's probably not surprising given how critical freight movement has been part of the supply chain while so many of us are stuck at home or severely restricted. So you see a lot more traffic and a lot more trucks on a lot of these urban roads. But the reality is, even with the larger and the heavier traffic, if you invest adequately, there's no reason those roads can't be maintained in good condition, but you do have to have that sustainable funding source. And unfortunately, that has been lacking for many local roads and highways.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Vern is with us in Neenah. Vern, hello.
Hello, I'm here. I can hear you.
Yep. What did you want to say, Vern?
My comment is I'm very disappointed in that we didn't raise the gas tax when it was low. We wouldn't have hardly knew about it. It wouldn't have hardly bothered us. We wouldn't have even thought about it. And we need to raise the gas tax so that other people from other states, everybody helps pay for it. But I don't know why the Republicans are so against it. It really burns me up. I drive a Prius hybrid car for the last 13 years I've driven it. I get 50 miles to a gallon. I barely use this highway. It's just a little light car.
Vern, I'm going to jump in because just have a few moments left. The idea of raising the gas tax, Rocky.
Well certainly as states are looking at the ability to bring in more revenue in the short term, in particular, the gas tax is the most equitable way to do it. The more you use it, the more you're going to pay for it. Registration fees are on the table. Wisconsin has one of the lowest registration fees, certainly in the Midwest, if not the country. And so that's another way. And then looking into really not the long term, but probably over the next decade, I think you're going to see state and government starting to look more closely at how do you align the fees you're paying with the amount you're driving, and how do you do it fairly? How do you do it without impacting people's privacy? A number of states are looking very closely at that. So I think the public ultimately is going to vote with their feet. They want a transportation system that's reliable, it's safe, and it's efficient, and they realize their need to pay for it. So it'll be finding the best way to do that.
Vern, thanks for the call. And Rocky, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Rob. Anytime.
We've been talking to Rocky Moretti, Director of Policy and Research at the National Transportation Research Nonprofit, TRIP. He talked to us about ways to improve the nation's and the state's transportation infrastructure. Thirty-nine Marquette University staff members were laid off in January as the campus navigated financial losses from COVID-19 and declining enrollment. Rich Kramer reports it's the latest in a series of cost-saving measures that some on campus fear are pulling the state's largest private college away from its commitment to small class sizes, liberal arts education, and even its Jesuit mission.
On a cold, late January day, a group of around 30 faculty, staff, and students gathered outside Marquette's administration building to protest the recent firing of more than three dozen staff members. At the protest, French professor Sarah Gendron was skeptical about claims from campus administrators that no additional layoffs are planned.
They're bragging about it being just 39 cuts at this point. Will there be more? Absolutely.
A Marquette spokeswoman told WPR no administrators would be available for interviews about the layoffs or the 225 employee cuts outlined in the campus's 2022 budget. She said other actions like retirement buyouts and consolidation of administrative positions had addressed budget issues. Savannah Charles is a senior at Marquette and a member of the university's Student Government Association.
Even if this is the end of the firing, we're still quite upset about losing 39 Marquette staff members. I think there are a large number of us who want those positions and individuals reinstated.
Well before the COVID-19 pandemic, Marquette shrunk its staffing in anticipation of projected declines in enrollment. In 2019, it laid off 24 people and left 49 other positions vacant. Marquette President Michael Lovell pointed to a 2018 book written by economist Nathan Graw that predicts a 15% enrollment decline across the Midwest to begin after 2026. During a state legislative hearing last week, Graw told lawmakers that while the number of Wisconsin high school graduates will increase slightly by the middle of this decade, the trend will be short-lived.
And then we see a slide of something like 12%. If we look just south of your border to Illinois, we see a much deeper slide.
The Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education predicts the number of high school graduates in Illinois could fall by 22% by 2037. That's a big deal for Marquette, since that's where the majority of its undergraduate students come from. But some critics say those projections fail to consider that the students who go to college could change. Latin studies professor Sergio Gonzalez says when Marquette administrators talk about future enrollment declines, they're not talking about growing populations like Milwaukee's or Chicago's Hispanic communities.
What we're talking about is a very specific student population that's shrinking, which is that traditional student population of white, middle to upper class students that have been the normative population for the university for the last few decades.
A defining aspect of Marquette's identity is its Jesuit mission. In an open letter to administrators last month, the campus rector of the Jesuit community noted that a solid grounding in the humanities is indispensable to that mission. Recent Marquette graduate Brooke McArdle says the university is focusing cuts on liberal arts programs while sparing others like business, nursing, and engineering.
They really are doing what a lot of other universities are doing right now, which is unfortunate. They're going where the money is, and that's not what it means to be Jesuit. That's actually quite the opposite.
Marquette's administrators won't say where the cuts have been made, but the university's 2022 budget mentions 10 new positions in the fields of health sciences and nursing. Professor and Academic Senate Chair Sumana Chattopadhyay doesn't believe the campus's mission is in jeopardy, but she understands the confusion and fear some employees have felt as administration worked to cut spending while also carrying a budget surplus from the previous year.
We did communicate to the leadership that maybe it had to be communicated in a better way so that people did not have that kind of anxiety or anger.
Marquette is far from the only university that's making budget changes based on its projections for the future. The question may be whether students, faculty, and administrators agree on what that future should look like. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, it can be frustrating to try to learn something new, music, sports, languages, whatever, but our guest says there's a unique joy that comes along with that kind of discovery. The author of the new book, Beginners, joins the show. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, check out a project in La Crosse that's helping veterans find housing they can afford. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, when is the last time you learned a new skill for the first time? Maybe drawing or a musical instrument, a sport or a craft? Once we leave childhood, we tend to leave behind the regular practice of trying to learn new stuff. The author of a new book explores the experience of being a beginner in all kinds of skills. Surfing, drawing, singing, chess, and how it keeps us more engaged in other facets of our lives. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. When was the last time you were a beginner at something? What do you think is so unique about being completely new to learning something? Have you taken up a new activity or tried to teach yourself something during the pandemic, something big or small? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tom Vanderbilt writes on design, technology, science, and culture. He's the author of several books. His latest is called Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
You write that you're inspired in part by being a new parent, and even more so when your daughter and then you started taking on a chess. Talk about how that experience inspired your quest to learn how and why grown-ups can learn.
Sure. My daughter was 4 at the time when she asked if we could play a game of chess. And this was sort of embarrassing for me, but I actually didn't know how. And I tried to learn the game myself to pick it up, but it's a pretty complex game. So I felt a little bit over my head, ended up hiring a coach. This coach came over to give my daughter some lessons. And then I figured, what, I'd like to learn this as well. Why should I just sort of sit on the sidelines? And this was a pattern in my life where I was taking my daughter, who had this, like all children do, this real hunger for learning. I was taking her to all these lessons and then just sort of sitting on my phone usually nearby. And I thought, you know what? What's the last new skill I learned? I'm going to plunge in and do some of the things she's doing as well as some other things. And that was sort of the idea.
And you learned something there that keeps coming up through your book. Kids learn things one way, and it seems like they're, you know, really good at it in their way. Adults learn things, it seems like, in a different way. What is it about being a grown-up that makes that new thing different than it is for that 4-year-old, say?
Yeah, I mean, there's two sort of broad categories here. There's the brain stuff, which, you know, kids just have these brains that are really optimized for learning, and they have these synapses that are, you know, sort of being connected, and just a real hunger. And they have a very quick, what's called fluid intelligence. Adults, you know, I was in my 40s. I had 4 decades of already learning a bunch of other stuff, which was sort of sitting in my brain like an old crowded hard drive on your computer. So for me to learn something new, you know, I've got to get past all that other stuff. And if I go to learn a new language, well, maybe it sounds a little bit like another language I learned, or maybe my English grammar gets in the way of my Spanish grammar. But so the brain is one thing, but there's the whole lifestyle question as well. I mean, children, number one, the very young children, most of the things they're learning are very important to them to learn. They're learning how to walk, to talk, to get along with other people. Adults, you know, when we learn, it tends to be, you know, sort of a more recreational thing, sort of hobbies. That's not necessarily survival at stake. But the other key thing there is pressure and fear. Kids, you know, just plunge in. They really don't know much pressure or fear. Adults, you know, overthink things. We worry about looking bad in front of other people. So it's hard.
Let's talk a little bit about the why. You know, if I pick up, and I have been trying to pick up new things. If I pick up something new at this stage in my life, I know I'm never going to be a star, an expert. It's not going to be my, I'm not going to make money doing it. So why do I want to learn a new thing in the first place, Tom?
Yeah, I think we've all been sort of, corrupted or whatever the word is by this 10,000 hours rule that people have probably heard about, which was from the sociologist Anders Ericsson, talking about how much practice you needed to become an expert level performer. Of course, you know, most of us don't have, you know, 100 hours to try to tackle something. But the good news is we don't need to be expert level performers. So I would argue that, you know, in 10 hours, I mean, the amount of time you might spend watching, binging a Netflix show, you could actually pick up some fairly decent skills in something like drawing. I mean, the great thing about the learning curve is that it's steep, which means at the beginning, you're making a lot of progress. There will be plateaus later, but that's the, sort of the great thing about learning, and what makes it so addictive in a way about being a beginner is that just that sort of excitement and thrill at the beginning, you're learning something new. And I would argue that you're really changing your self-identity a little bit. You're sort of expanding the notion of who you are. And then you can add these things to your sort of life resume, as it's been called. Like, I'm so-and-so, I'm a this, I'm a that, I'm a singer. It took me a while to feel comfortable calling myself a singer, but I'll own it now.
Now, one interesting thing you did was surfing, not a community, you write, that's necessarily known for being welcoming to the newcomer. But one thing you learned there and took as a lesson, and this is generally true, you can make some early progress, but there's often a point you hit where you get worse, or at least it feels like you get worse. It's the U-shaped learning curve. What is that, and how can we keep going past it?
Yeah, I mean, progress is not always linear. If you're learning to do something like surf, one day you'll go to the ocean, to the surf break, feels like you've got it dialed in, you're hitting all of these waves. The next day, maybe the conditions change just a little bit, something is off, you're still learning, and you catch zero waves. And there's various reasons for that, but often what's happening is you're approaching some sort of plateau, and you know when it hurts, when your brain hurts, that's when you're learning. You know, the sad thing here is that, you know, when it feels good, that's when you've learned it, and that's a very nice feeling to have as an adult, to feel competent in something. But that means the learning has stopped. So if you're going to go after that next goal, it's going to have to hurt again. And that, again, is something that, you know, humans quite naturally try to avoid when possible, is having things frustrate them. But that is when learning is actually happening.
Talking to Tom Vanderbilt about his new book, Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tackled learning something new, or maybe relearning something you used to do as a grown-up? What was it? How'd it go? Did you keep up with it? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Tom, you mentioned becoming a singer. And you hadn't been someone who people thought of as a singer. You went and you looked for a singing group that was, you know, easy enough for you to get into, but hard enough and good enough to present a challenge to you. Why was that the level you were shooting for?
Yeah, a psychologist call that desirable difficulty, where, you know, you're pushed just a little bit beyond the edge of your comfort zone. And, you know, I had been taking these private vocal lessons, which were fun, and I was making a lot of progress, but it also felt a little bit sterile. I was, you know, sort of like, imagine, you know, doing soccer drills in a gym day after day, like kicking the ball against the wall. I wanted to get out and sort of be in a real environment, like a game. So, you know, a choir to me seemed the safe zone where I could be out in public performing, but have 50 or 60 people around me. So it wasn't, you know, no solos involved here. But but again, like, that's the great thing about learning a class in a class or a group with people. There were people of varying skill sets around me. I could draw upon their experience. When I was, after I was there a little while, suddenly I had a little bit of experience. I could sort of tell when a new person had joined the choir and they had that deer in the headlights sort of look. And then I became, you know, let's say a small scale expert. But that's sort of, there's sort of a magic sweet spot that happens with people learning new things together. It's called a community of practice. And you know, we can use each other as a resource, not just the teacher.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Milwaukee. Dan, hello.
Hello. All right, let me start off by saying my motto is everything is easy. All you have to do is try. And for the pandemic, I remodeled a bathroom, made a Volkswagen trike, built it out of a car, and got into EDM music composition with drum machines and synthesizers and all that. So.
Well, let's take that musical composition, Dan. Had you done something like that before?
No. I actually have no rhythm whatsoever. That's why I had to do it electronically.
I love it. Dan, thank you so much for sharing that. So, I don't know. Dan thinks everything's easy if you try it. There's still some challenges along the way, though, Tom, but I do like that attitude.
Yeah, and sometimes these things are sort of, you know, placed upon us from the outside. I mean, what he was saying about remodeling his bathroom, I've just moved into a house. I've been living in an apartment for many years where the super took care of things. Suddenly I'm in this house. I'm kind of a beginner in owning a house. So, you know, all these home maintenance things that a lot of people take for granted, they're like very new to me. And I've already been making, you know, some stupid mistakes, but I'm trying.
Now, and Dan also mentioned he's doing this stuff during the pandemic. You started this book, this project, at least, Tom, pre-pandemic. Do you see people taking on this idea of, hey, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to try something new?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, the pandemic, one thing about it is that it really turned us all into beginners of a sort. I mean, no one really was that cognizant in Zoom or remote schooling via computer for elementary school children. I mean, they're all wearing a mask. There were all these things we had to sort of fit into our daily life that were new and prevent, you know, it was a little bit unsettling. And after a little while, we got the drill. But you're right. So that sense of disruption, people, you know, didn't have their normal commute to work. They had a little extra time, or they weren't able to do the things they normally did, opened this huge window. And you basically look at all these metrics, like websites like Duolingo, the language app, or sales of guitars and guitar lesson sites, or chess learning websites have all absolutely exploded during the pandemic. If you're a gardener, you can't order seeds right now. I mean, there's just, we sort of had, you know, we're hitting peak hobby, I think, which I think is great news, but it's definitely at a different place than I was a few years ago when I started the book.
We're talking to Tom Vanderbilt about his new book. It's called Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's the last thing you took on to learn as a beginner? Have you ever learned something as a parent at the same time maybe as your kid? Have you taken on some new activity or tried to teach yourself something during the pandemic, big or small? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Tom Vanderbilt, author of the new book, Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you taken on something new in your adult life? What was it? How'd it go? Did you feel self-conscious doing something that you just weren't that good at? Call 800-642-1234. We got an email from Pete in Reedsburg. Pete says he took up guitar at age 66. Guitar for the first time. He's working on a YouTube channel. He says, the nice thing about trying new things when you're old is that not only do you not care what others think of you, you've had time to figure out they were never thinking of you at all. Thanks for sending that in, Pete. And that's a thing for me, Tom, overcoming the self-consciousness. I've been trying to learn Spanish on one of those free language apps and some other ways. Long streak going. Great. I know the thing I need to do is find places where I have to speak to people in Spanish, and I'm just scared. I get paid to talk for a living, and the idea of, you know, talking worse than a little kid could talk, I don't know, it fills me with anxiety. How do we overcome, as Pete has, that self-consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. You know, we spend our adult lives trying to project an image of competence. You know, you're working on your job, your career, your resume. You don't highlight the things you're not that good at on your resume. So to suddenly go out there in public and be sort of bad at something, you know, but he's right, you know, that there is this, on the other hand, there's this thing called imposter syndrome, where sometimes even in our jobs, we're sort of thinking, are we really that qualified? But that's what's sort of so liberating about plunging into something, especially with a class of other beginners. So then you're kind of all at, you know, square one, that you're not worried about imposter syndrome because no one actually expects you to be any good. And I think a lot of that, I think, comes with age definitely helps, I think, put a little bit of that stuff in the rearview mirror and you lose that fear. But yeah, so I still suffer from it myself. I mean, it's not something that you can do away with, I think.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Sandy is with us in Mauston. Sandy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What have you learned, Sandy?
Well, I tell you, I'm a retired teacher. I used to do substitute teaching until COVID, and I had to do something. So I watched a lot of tutorials, and I'm learning to paint.
Cool. How's
and
it going?
I'm absolutely loving it.
Uh-huh. And do you feel like you're picking it up pretty quick, Sandy?
I feel like I am, yes. There are communities on Facebook where you can post your pictures, your paintings, and you get feedback. And, yeah, I found out I can actually paint, and I'm even learning to draw.
Fantastic. I'm glad to hear that, Sandy. And I like that, Tom, that she's joined a community and they're, you know, they offer advice and hopefully positive, constructive feedback. But again, that idea of having a community of people you're learning with seems like a big boost for this, as you discovered, Tom.
Absolutely. I mean, the motivation, the sense of sort of responsibility of getting feedback. And it sounds like also that she is taking classes online, which is something that, you know, when I was working on my book, because I wanted to, you know, get out and meet people and hear their stories, I was doing all in-person classes. And then, of course, when COVID happened, all of this stuff shifted online. I was a bit skeptical in the beginning, but I've taken online drawing courses. And in some ways, there's things you can do with technology online that are as good as, or in some ways even better than in person. So I think that's sort of revolution. And there's a lot of stuff that's available for free or not that expensive, you know, classes, videos, you can hire coaches all around the world, has really, again, made this sort of a golden age of learning, I think.
Thanks a lot for the call, Sandy. Keep it up for sure. We'll go to Ted now in Spooner. Ted, hello.
Yeah, hello.
What are you doing, Ted, or what have you done?
Well, when I was 65, I tried downhill or snowboarding. I downhill skiing, but I switched over to snowboard. Well, that was a challenge. But I can say one thing. The younger people thought it was really cool that I was trying, and they stopped by and gave me hints left and right on how to do it.
All right. Did you keep it up, Ted, or was it a one-off like my downhill skiing experience was?
Well, I'd done it for 4 or 5 years, but now I had a total knee replacement, and the other knee is about ready to go. I don't think I should try it again.
That seems very reasonable. Ted, thank you for sharing that. That was one of the things, Tom, that you and I think your daughter again tried together.
Yeah, I'm not much of a skier, and I was not a snowboarder at all. But, you know, again, just I thought, okay, let's try it. And, you know, I sort of had this magic transformation of, and this is what I'm trying to, you know, urge in people. Just after one day, I had become basically a snowboarder. I'm not saying I was good at all, but I had ridden on a snowboard down a hill, which I think qualifies as a snowboarder. And this had not been in my life at all. And I mean, the caller raised a couple other interesting things. You know, there's this thing about one thing that's when learning a new skill, one frustrating thing is that the skills often don't transfer as well as we think they might. You'd think snowboarding and skiing are pretty identical, but there's a lot of different things there. And it can be hard, you know, the longer you've been doing one sport, to sort of switch over. And they do say snowboarding is easier to in the beginning and then harder to master. And it's the opposite with skiing. I'm not sure if that's actually true, but kudos to Ted for, you know, not letting age get in the way. And I'm 52 now, but I've had experiences of doing things like playing video games, online video games with my daughter, Fortnite squads. And I get kudos from her 9-year-old friends. I'm not sure what that's worth, but you know, again, it's about sort of looking forward and not thinking you're ever too old or anything's inappropriate for you to learn, you know, at any age.
Now, can you talk about getting through the moments of frustration, that U-shaped curve we talked about earlier where I thought I was getting good and now I'm getting worse or at best plateauing? How do we power through that to get to the good side again?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you just really have to walk away. I mean, rest. And there's, you know, sometimes taking a week off and your brain sort of works on the puzzles that you had in your head without even knowing it subconsciously and sort of sorts it out almost magically, I would say. And there's coaches have all sorts of tricks as well, too. I mean, just in terms of learning juggling, for example, I would sometimes be struggling and I seemed like I had it. Then I suddenly couldn't get it. I almost, you know, had the equivalent of writer's block, but for juggling, I just couldn't juggle. So they would say, well, you know, change the room you're doing it in, change the backdrop you're throwing the balls against, change the hand you throw the ball with first, change the objects you're throwing. Basically just change is good. It sort of like sparks the brain into thinking, approaching a problem from a new angle, which is really, you know, another thing that learning really is. It's just finding new solutions to new problems as they arise. If you do one drill too much, you sort of like over practice something and it's really diminishing returns because it will only help solve one problem, or something like snowboarding, a lot of different things can happen. So you need to be very flexible. And this is something that another thing that really distinguishes infant and child learners is that kind of flexibility. They learn a lot through playful exploration, which includes a lot of mistakes as well.
In our last few moments, Tom, you've learned singing, surfing, juggling, chess, Fortnite, you just mentioned. Do you have your eye on your next learning project?
Well, my daughter just joined a mountain biking club, so I have on order a mountain bike. It's coming to me, but because of COVID, there's a huge demand for these sorts of things. So it's been a little bit delayed, but I expect to be out on the hills pretty soon.
All right. Well, best of luck to you on that. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to Tom Vanderbilt. He writes about things like design, technology, science, and culture. He's written a bunch of books. We've been talking about his latest. It's called Beginners, The Joy and Transformative Power of Lifelong Learning. There's still time for you to share your new thing, something you have been learning in the last few years, maybe the last few months. Tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What is new to you? How's it going? How did you learn it? How are you learning it? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, from toilet paper to camping gear to jigsaw puzzles, the pandemic has led to short-term shortages of a lot of different products. We'll find out how supply chains get slowed down for high-demand stuff and how they bounce back. Western Wisconsin is getting hit hard with farm bankruptcies. We'll find out why and what it could take to get the dairy economy working for smaller producers in the region. And cold weather in Wisconsin, and it's hitting some unexpected places around the country. A meteorologist tells us what's going on. We were just talking about trying new things in life. That reminds me of the time in my 20s when I tried to teach myself to draw. Spoiler alert, it did not go well. But maybe my problem is that I wasn't thinking big enough. An artist in Philadelphia last month completed a picture that's been certified as the largest drawing ever completed by a single artist. As reported by CNN, a large-scale drawing by artist Diamond Whipper Young clocks in at over 6,500 square feet, the medium of art Crayola markers on paper. It took her 63 hours to complete the artwork over the course of 5 days. Now, 6,500 square feet, I pulled out the calculator. That comes out to about 81 feet by 81 feet, if it was a square. The huge drawing is on display at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia as part of a new exhibit there on creativity. From the pictures, it looks like a city street scene with an open field. There's an undersea portion as well, and a lighthearted, cartoonish style. So, I don't know, maybe I should tackle something like that. Step one, you need to find a really, really big room and lots of paper. And then learn to draw. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.